What's up, Eric? How are you?
Good. How are you, Finn?
Good, thanks. I am going to invite you as a co-host. Dreamcatcher, welcome. You're invited as a co-host. I don't know how many we can have, but... Did you guys get the... Okay, so you've got yours, Eric. Cool. All right. How's your week going?
Dude, it's crazy. It's already Friday. It's also been like a month's worth of work this week. So...
I bet.
How are things with you guys?
Good, good. We're, you know, aggressively building testnets going strong on the back end. Front end designs are underway and just moving along nicely. So it's definitely a good time to be building.
Dude, it's honestly, bear markets are kind of nice just because it's quiet and you get to just focus on building a bunch of stuff out. I mean, the other parts of it suck, like, but at the same time, it's peace and quiet and you get to build.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that this is, I view it more of as an opportunity. And I think that's how, you know, people who are still bullish on the industry are viewing it as well. And the best part about that, like you're saying, no distractions, no, hype, no like unnecessary, like, you know, sideshows, if you will. So it's really great for our developers. I think that they're able to move a lot faster because of this. And I think that it also takes a lot of pressure off in terms of, you know, when do we need a launch, right? Because time is on your side in a bear market in terms of getting the development done. So we're pretty optimistic that this is actually just a real gift, you know.
100%. Gotta move past a lot of the immature narratives and towards, you know, the ethos of Web3. Everyone thinks, oh, we're going to get to a place where it's Web 2.5 and this all happens behind the scenes and Web3 is all special and whatnot, but not everyone knows they're using it. And that stuff has to be built out. And if you don't have to build that out to make a whole bunch of money because you can make a monkey picture, then devs are going to stop short. It's hard to make rich people work.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's another great way to look at it. So we have... From our team, we've got Dreamcatcher Mitchell. So three of us from LS Network here. Eric, you are with Astro Vault. Do you have other members of your team that will be joining today?
If you want to bring Ethan up, he's a...
Oh, great. Okay, we'll make him a speaker. They invited to speak. Okay, we have this recorded, so hopefully we'll get some more people to jump on as we go. So Eric or Ethan, whoever wants to go first, can you tell us a little bit about Astro Vault and what you guys are building there?
So Astro Vault is just another AMM, but you know, one of the first ones that actually makes revenue. We kind of wanted to build out solid infrastructure. We saw the really quick 2 to 4 year turnover rate, and you know, incentivize liquidity to a platform. Token dies, incentives die, liquidity leaves because there's no actual revenue and it's all kind of, you know, a bubble. And we wanted to build something that could last so that we could get this Web2 integration that I'm, you know, idealistically hoping for with more solidified financial infrastructure. So we redesigned the DEX model so that the liquidity is actually like still on-chain and privately available, but actually earning revenue for the protocol itself directly. Applications are directly securing the chains that they're on and just... actually making money so that the tokens have value, so the incentives are worthwhile, and everything people have been trying to do in DeFi actually makes sense, and you could do it for a longer period of time with an eventuality of earning past the need for perpetual incentive, needs for perpetual incentivization by liquidity retention. A lot of big words for we just built an AMM that actually earns revenue.
It's a very cool concept. I've been reading about it as well. So what was your rationale for launching as a layer two? And you launched basically on Archway versus launching as your own layer one.
So my background's in economic philosophy, and so I economists are really good at optimizing the systems that are in place. Economic philosophers are much more geared towards questioning the systems that are in place, trying to understand them and build new ones. And going back to first principles, it's like, why is a blockchain valuable? Everyone just kind of assumes that they are, and they've had high valuations in the past, but fundamentally, they're really expensive and they don't earn revenue. And so if we launch our own blockchain, our expenses go up and our expenses go up, our revenue stays the same. So why? There are other perfectly good blockchains. I mean, we have tons of blockchains that are using less than 1% of their block space. Like, I'd rather just pay a tiny bit for somebody else's block space than, have to raise an additional $10 million and sustain a giant team to just make the world's 5,000th blockchain,
That's a great point, in terms of why you chose it. I will say from our perspective at Ellis Network, we chose to launch our own layer one blockchain because we believe the control we have over the chain can directly impact revenue generation. So we kind of try to tackle the same problem, but we do it in a different way by having good control over our blockchain. So a lot of that, obviously, I think when we look at layer one blockchains that are not successful, a lot of that comes from their token distribution, right? Or what we commonly refer to as tokenomics. And some of that maybe is kind of like the growing pains of just maturing the industry and trying to understand really how to create proper tokenomics, so to speak. So when you had these high inflation models, they were great for attracting people in the very beginning in a bull market. And I think that started to get out in front of the actual purpose of the blockchain. And so people were kind of coming for the wrong reasons. And so the people that you were anticipating to be your user of that blockchain was not really a user. They were just coming to try to capture that inflation through staking rewards and sell them off and things like that. And you could get away with that in a bull market. So maybe that's kind of overshadowed the actual purpose of of these blockchains and why they appear to be unsuccessful. I do think the next round of layer one blockchains that are coming in are actually tackling this problem from the very beginning with smart token distributions. So I think we can generate revenue of at Ellis Network through that as a prerequisite. But the case to actually make the revenue is users coming to use the product. So I think hopefully your approach works and hopefully our approach works. I think we can achieve the same goal in a different manner, but it is really cool to see us trying to kind of tackle these problems in a different way.
100%. And from going all the way out and building this out, like, there's plenty to be said for the better user experience of having your own blockchain, as well as the control that you have. Like, we're still limited by the security of the chains that we're on, and like, that's already a risk. But then additionally, like, if you go and use Astro Vault, it's like, oh cool, you can drag and drop widgets and stuff, you can move assets and whatnot. But if we had our own blockchain, we could do more things, such as like have everything immediately sorted by a user's portfolio or whatnot. But if we do that on other chains, we could DDoS the network. If we had more control, we could provide a better user experience. So there are benefits. The benefits have a cost, and everyone's cost benefit ratio is different. Our thoughts is, it's cheaper to launch as an application. We can always launch a chain later on if we choose to migrate. So we may very well end up being an app chain in the future. We're not starting that way. We're going to give this a shot.
Yeah, that's totally understandable. And I see that you guys have a decent start with your liquidity, looking at your statistics page on astrovault.io. So, I wish you guys continued, growth and success as you guys continue to tackle this problem. I think one of the things that we like to talk about, in the DeFi world is lessons learned, right? What were the mistakes made in the past? And what can we do moving forward to really get to that next level of DeFi, whether we're calling it 1.5, 2, 3, or whatever we're calling it? What are the keys to getting to a sustainable DeFi model? And you can speak to that. Maybe we'll offer our thoughts as well.
In my opinion, like, obviously, as it's come through at this point, revenue is important. My biggest concerns in DeFi right now, as we do build these like stacks on stacks on stacks of applications, as it's designed to, as should be an inevitability, is that like, you're only as strong as the axioms. You're only as strong as your foundations. And we're building out these protocols fundamentally with collateralization understood by valuation rather than by liquidity, which is like, it is an economic fallacy. They can work in traditional finance because you can deal with the float, but float doesn't work as well when you have to have the assets provably collateralized on chain. The traditional finance has the benefits of being able to do bailouts, of being able to do bankruptcies without fundamentally destroying everything else. And DeFi doesn't. So even something like DAI is like, oh, it's an over-collateralized stablecoin. It falls susceptible to the exact same issues that Terra Luna did. It's just a little bit safer of saying like, oh, we have $22 billion worth of collateral and $20 billion worth of debt. It's like, yeah, judging by market cap, judging by valuation, but you actually only have access to like $50 million of liquidity, which is the real collateral behind the debt. And the more we see correlated assets do this together, as like now the DAI model gets replicated in less liquid assets, the more scary it is for protocol collapse. And then anything built on top of these protocols that are doing this can topple down as well. So DeFi needs to move past this, and it's going to be difficult and probably needs some kind of level of centralization. So I'm skeptical, but I'm just watching around there.
Those are really great points. I think we identified this, you know, similar issue in terms of what is the value proposition? How do you maintain the actual valuation, so to speak, of your chain or of your actual product that you're offering in Web3? And for us, that is actually the main reason why we selected USDC as our base token for our liquidity pools. We saw that basically if we were going to use Ellis as the pair token, we would constantly fight this battle. Okay, how do we give Ellis value? What is the backing of Ellis? How can we collateralize it, etc.? And instead of having to constantly have that hanging over our heads, which I think you brought up a great point on that, it's better to just have it backed by a real world asset, right? So yes, fiat is inflationary. You know, the US dollar is inflationary, but at least we're aware of it. We can monitor it. We know exactly what it's backed by. So for us, having that USDC as our base pair for the pools is that first step, right, to getting to that, hey, I this is no kidding what my project is actually worth, because it's there. I can actually cash it in. So that's the big one there, I think, as a starting point. It's still not the driver for revenue, right? It's still just a prerequisite. So we are, you know, building on things that we think are going to actually at least give us that security and safety that is necessary, right, to take DeFi to the next level. So that, I mean, that's a really, really great discussion point.
Thank you. I'm curious, what else do you think is a fundamental like issue with DeFi, at least 1.0, that you would like to see solved or that still makes you nervous?
For us, it's been essentially the hoops that a new user has to jump through to become a DeFi user. You know, I think a lot of us kind of wore that as like a badge of honor, right? To learn how to create a wallet, how to safeguard it, storing the keys, good best practices. And some of us along the way have been burned, right? Whether it's losing the keys or getting hacked, et cetera. So those challenges are unfortunately, as much as some of us wear them as a badge of honor, are unfortunately what's keeping, you know, let's say 99% of the rest of the users out there from wanting to dip their toe in. It's just too hard. And so it shouldn't be hard, right? I mean, the whole point of Web3 is really to, you know, give people the tools that they need to have a little more freedom, right? The decentralized concept is so that you don't rely on some centralized entity, that you don't rely on somebody else handling things for you, that you have control over it yourself. So unlocking that power, that freedom to have a little more control over your financial future, is still going to require some methods that are going to make it easier to make the transition. So that's been a big focus of ours. When we started Ellis Network, really we started building the ideas, you know, late last year, 2022, and we didn't really start building until earlier this year. But that's been at the forefront in terms of design. So for us, it's going to be, how do we take somebody who is used to using their regular banking products, you know, whether it be on their desktop or mobile, their brokerage products, et cetera, you know, whatever they're used to interacting with on a day-to-day basis, and how do we make that transition where they've used that app and now they're coming to Ellis and they're going to feel just as comfortable using our app? And so I think that's still very much missing when you look at decentralized exchanges, very much missing. I think centralized exchanges are definitely ahead because I think they've one, they've got a lot more money to spend on it. And two, they probably get that feedback a lot more directly because they do mostly KYC their users, et cetera. So they can get direct feedback. So I think that's going to be when we solve that on the decentralized level, I think you're going to see a massive influx of users coming.
Yeah, 100%. I'm really excited for what Account Abstraction is going to open up for that. One comparison I make pretty often, one in terms of collateralization, but I think it also applies to user experience, is security versus scalability. The reason Terra got so big is because, oh, well, this is an infinitely scalable stablecoin, and the reason it's infinitely scalable is because you print it out of nowhere. So the security is nothing. But that's why it got big, because the security is nothing, because it was scalable. And if you made something that was more secure, it wouldn't be scalable, it wouldn't be as fun to invest in. And so things like DGED, for example, don't really go anywhere because they're not exciting. Similarly, like a solid DEX that it has users' funds provably safe and authentic, and like say you're using a ledger, like now you're pressing a ton of buttons, you're going through a bunch of verifications to make everything happen. It's like, oh, well, this user experience sucks. And a lot of the ways that users, like that we can make it more efficient and more seamless for users is by like hiding the keys and like using different types of wallets that are far less safe. So I'm hoping that with Account Abstraction, with like new key solutions that are coming to place, we're able to make more steps in that direction. Because yeah, as far as I'm concerned, we're kind of at a standstill right now.
Agreed. And I'm pretty excited about some of the options that are rolling out right now. So even, you know, obviously I think some of us who first created our, you know, our first Kepler wallets back in the day, you know, saw that you could actually just be a Google user, right? Which I know that's a centralized solution, but you could be a Google user and you could log in and have Kepler create your account under your Gmail, and then you could essentially never have to really worry about safeguarding your keys. They would send you a private key, but they wouldn't send you the recovery keys that would be just associated with your Google account. And for a lot of people, that was a great first step to dip their toe in that water, and they could start interacting with a DEX. They could start using Osmosis or Crescent or whatever. But the great part about that is you're not stuck with it, right? Because once you've graduated, once you've kind of learned how to use that, now you say, okay, well, I want to take it to the next level. I'm going to start using serious funds here. I better learn that next level. I better learn to get, you know, purchase a ledger and learn how to safeguard it, right? So that's kind of, that's a transition, right? It's a segue, and we're good with that. I think that's a really fantastic way for somebody to come in. You know, Account Abstraction, you got your, whether it's through Kepler, Web3 Auth, and some of the other ones that are going to be rolling out. So we're looking at that, and we're certainly going to integrate some of that for our front end. So somebody who comes and interacts with the LS DEX can basically be up and running in a matter of seconds. And that's what we want initially, so they can get educated. And then when they start really thinking about, okay, I'm going to start putting some funds at risk here, some real funds at risk, maybe I do want to start taking security to the next level. And that's the user's option, right? We want something for everybody.
Absolutely. And I love that idea of like starting them off easy, and then maybe them, once they choose to care more about the security, then taking that extra steps. But and then also the other direction is there will likely be like multi-wallet solutions with single key pairings from something like a Gmail account, where if you're never, like if what you're using crypto for never requires a large or even like any balance directly on a wallet at any time, you could constantly be fluctuating wallets and never have to go any deeper and constantly just be using the crypto to route through some blockchain solution and not need to get a ledger, not need to have any complicated stuff ever while still getting the benefits of the blockchain. And for something like that, hopefully it never needs to go deeper and we're able to keep it super easy and more scalable for users. So like, I mean, if the use cases are as endless as we like to think that they are, so will the types of user experiences required. So it's an interesting space for sure.
Yeah, I love thinking about that too, because you know, people are constantly talking about, when is Web3 going to be this, you know, officially in place? When is it going to be this big mainstream concept that, you know, that users are familiar with? And the reality is, I mean, you know, there's not just one day where you wake up in the morning and all of a sudden Web3 is a thing, right? There's no ribbon cutting ceremony, as I've said before. What really ends up happening is it's this transition over 5, 10, 15 years, right? So I think I've mentioned this before as well. There wasn't really this one day that, like, you know, we officially declared Web 1 was dead and Web 2 was alive, right? And if you ask somebody, well, when did Web 2 really start? You're going to get dozens of different answers, because there's no real time that it happened. But what did happen is along the way, people started doing things that they would do off, you know, the internet and started doing it on the internet, whether it be banking, whether it be streaming, whether it be, you know, the many other functions that exist today on the web. But those are all things that are very seamless. It's not like people want to know exactly what's happening on the back end. What they really care about is that they interact with the front end, and the thing that they're trying to do with a few button clicks works as expected. So that's like a perfect, you know, when you talk about, you know, somebody wanting to move funds or do things that they, you know, using a blockchain, but they don't really even interact with it. They don't really know that they're interacting with it. That is when I think Web3 will be mature.
Yeah, Heidegger would call it ready at hand, and that you don't actually know what the object is for itself, but rather its value and its identity is in how it is used. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, all the people who thought telephones were a joke all have a phone. All the people who thought internets were a joke are now using the internet on their phone. We were always told we wouldn't have a calculator in our pocket and we had to learn math, and we always have a calculator in our pocket. Like, everyone who hates crypto right now is going to use it. It's a matter of how we build that up and how we're able to actually provide the value. And so my biggest concern is, like, we know Web3 is going to succeed. Most people at this point know Web3 is going to succeed. They might be one cycle away from acknowledging that. But the shape that it takes early on is going to drastically define how it is used long-term. Similar to the Web2 creating kind of how it did, it set up the next 40 years for an internet that only made marketing efficient. If we set things up right now on faulty bases, then we're going to... It's probably most efficient to design all of Web3 to collapse in 10 years. And that scares the shit out of me, because I want it to exist a lot longer and to, you know, for the most part, avoid societal collapse whenever possible. So it's just, it's interesting. Hopefully we can all keep doing cool shit and making sure the right projects, the right teams, the right mindsets take over, because they're always going to be a little bit less efficient than something more bubbly.
Yep. Absolutely. And you think about, you know, the bear market being that opportunity for us to kind of reset, right? And the same thing happened, you know, call it 23 years ago with the dot-com bubble, where you had all these companies basically tripping over themselves to go public to be these internet companies, right? And so it seemed like a great idea. Everybody knew the internet was the next big frontier and they were jumping on board, but they were just throwing money at anything that called themselves an internet company. And so when I saw that happening in 2021, you know, 2020, 2021 with the crypto industry, you know, it reminded me, because I am old enough to remember that. And I think about, wow, you know, we're going through that exact same growing pain, right? That we have a fantastic industry. There's going to be a huge total addressable market. There's going to be a lot that's going to be accomplished from, you know, essentially you'll be able to sectorize the Web3 industry and have just about everything that exists, for example, in the S&P 500 will probably be replicated on the Web3. But a lot of people came with ideas and failed along the way, and they'll continue to fail. But the good news is, with this reset opportunity we're having right now, is kind of going to keep the serious players in, so to speak, right? And a lot of the people who are just trying to ride the wave in this most recent cycle, you know, whether they got burned or whether they were discovered as not having the best interests of the users in mind, et cetera, this is our chance to now slow it down, build it correctly, right? And so we're pretty excited. I'm super thankful that I got a chance to get to know the people that I've gotten to know as we learn these lessons, you know, along the way. And it's really cool now that the people here that are building are trying to do it for the right reasons, for the right cause, and to get that mass adoption, and not for the quick, you know, ride up the elevator, you know, in a bull market. So I'm very excited about this.
100%. Can you walk me through who you guys like have identified as your potential customer base and what customer acquisition looks like from you? This is just something that's been fascinating me. Even though like DEXs seems like a crowded space right now, there are really different target markets and attempted user acquisition and acquisition costs and lifetime value for different customer types for different goals.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. So for us, we are trying to actually capture the full diversified market of DeFi users. So obviously that means that, you know, not just existing DeFi users, but people who are looking to dip their toe in the water or don't even know that they're ready to use DeFi. So I'll try to explain that a little bit, because I know that's a very like broad answer. But for example, right now we have very, very knowledgeable advanced DeFi users out there right now. They're on Osmosis, they're on Kujira, they're on Crescent. You have your arbitrage traders, you have your margin traders, over on GMX, right? You have people who are scalping, people who are going in and out of the pools, people providing liquidity. Those I would call those your advanced users, right? And so we definitely want them because they are the OGs. They've been here for a long time and they get it. They'll be the easiest people to onboard in terms of, if we showcase the product and they like using it and they like what's there, the options there for them, they'll come and use it, right? And that one is, we think probably the easiest to reach because they're already here. But then we want to diversify with our product offerings. So we're going to launch with margin trading. So that's going to allow a lot of our advanced users to come. So your GMX user, for example, they'll want to have some options, especially since it will be a Cosmos centric, initially, DEX. So that advanced user is going to be a real driver for revenue generation because margin trading will be one of our best revenue generators. That extra revenue that we generate from these types of leveraged products for the advanced users are going to give us more possibilities to go out and reach the newer or less experienced user. We can go out and reach out and touch them. So, I think of this as like, for example, when Tesla launched the Model X or when Lucid launched the Air, right? They went for the most expensive product first. They went for the flagship product that they could generate the most revenue off of, which gave them money to go and build the Model 3, right? The lesser expensive vehicle that they could go out and get the mainstream. So that's kind of how I view how we're taking this approach. So this diversified product offering we're going to have is going to go from the most risk hungry, if you will, the people willing to take the most risk, all the way down to the least risk. So the people who are the most risk averse, who are maybe looking in to deposit some USDC and get it like a passive yield, right? Where they'll essentially just, I don't want to take any risk. I just want to earn a small yield off my deposit, and that's good enough for me, right? And then somewhere in between, you'll have the pools. So you'll have, depending on the risk you're willing to take, a stable. You could just have your paired pool with like maybe Atom USDC or Ethereum USDC, and it's kind of a known quantity. You're working with a large cap type token, and then you could take your risk all the way down to the higher risk low market cap tokens. But what we really like that we're going to try to offer somewhere in the middle is those molecule pools. So they'll act like ETFs, basically, where you'll have 3, 4, 5, you name it, assets all bundled into one pool, which now gives a more diversified risk offering for a lot of our users. So that's kind of how we're trying to essentially capture the different risk tolerances. But it is going to require us to capture the most advanced users first, essentially, and while we're out there trying to get the web 2 to web 3 user, so to speak. But I definitely would love to hear your thoughts as well on how you'll be capturing your user base.
Just real quick on the molecule pools, that's fascinating. Obviously, I do a ton of research into this kind of stuff. Are you using units of liquidity? And how do you source impermanent loss? I'm just curious how this functions.
So for impermanent loss, one of the things that we've kind of tried to do to tamp that down, right, is use USDC as our base token. So when you think of, for example, if you had Crescent, you were pairing your token with Crescent on the Crescent DEX, Crescent Osmo or Crescent Atom, Crescent, Juno, you are now dealing with the price fluctuations of both tokens, right? So you could suffer impermanent loss with the movement of either side of that pool. And that's a risk that a lot of users don't like taking, or they don't like looking at, right? So for us, having that USDC base pair, yes, you can still suffer impermanent loss, of course, right? Because of the other side of the pool, but you now have removed one element of that. And so that's a big driver for us is why we chose that USDC along with obviously that backing, that real world backing. But then secondly, we've added a couple other designs to incentivize people to stay in the pool. So one of the things we're actually really excited to showcase about our pools is that we don't have any lock whatsoever. So somebody joining a liquidity pool can jump in and 2 minutes later they can jump out, right? So it's a stark difference from a lot of other DEXs where they'll jump in and their minimum period of being in the pool is, let's say, 7 days, 14 days, et cetera. We're letting people get out of the pool whenever they want. And the reason that is because we are driving our basically our rewards of pooling are going to favor the pooler. So right now, if you're an arbitrage trader, for example, price slippage, et cetera, usually it's the arbitrage traders that can usually capture that, grab it, and then run off to the next DEX, et cetera. But we're actually taking things like slippage, we're actually rewarding it to the liquidity provider instead of the actual user using the DEX, right? Because we don't want people to be harmed by slippage. So that's one of the ways we tackle that, which overall means that people won't have to sit there and take an impermanent loss and then like jump out of the pool and just be frustrated and leave, right? So I know that's kind of not specifically answering that question about impermanent loss, because I know that's still kind of a lingering issue. But what we're trying to do is incentivize people to stay. So impermanent loss sort of tamps itself out over time, right? Because if you are genuinely invested in that pool and you're genuinely, you know, a holder of that token and want to stay in it, you should experience price appreciation over time if your asset is worth it.
Hey guys, one thing I also wanted to add about these molecule tokens is that we're actually using an Oracle-based pricing model. What that means is that we're not actually following the AMM bonding curve for these molecule pools, and actually using Oracle-based pricing, which tells you that instead of following the bonding curve, which generally tends to lead to impermanent loss, we actually move up and down the bonding curve, different bonding curves, because we're using an Oracle pricing. So we are hence what's going to happen is that these pools are not going to be fixed weighted pools like AMM, which leads to impermanent losses. It will be dynamic weighted pools, and we essentially have some sort of a target ratio in which we want these molecules to end up with. Like, you know, as Haitian mentioned, these are essentially ETF style index pools with different weights. So the weights will keep moving around depending on how people are trading the pool, how people are getting in and out of the pool, swapping, as well as adding liquidity and removing liquidity. What we have in place is an incentive model, which kind of like tries to capture that difference between the target weight of the pool and where the current weight is. So we incentivize that with revenue share coming from the pool, and so then we basically hope that these incentives will be aligned to bring the weights back to the target weight. That's essentially how we're running these pools. They are dynamic weighted, but the cool thing is, since we're using Oracle pricing, as Haitian mentioned, the slippage of these pools are going back to the liquidity providers. They're not going to the arbitrage guys, which is actually a big deal, because if you look at most of the AMM pools, they're essentially closed models where you don't really know what's happening outside your own AMM model, and you're kind of like dependent on your own liquidity, your own pricing. And it's really the arbitrage guys who come in and bring those pools back in line. In our case, we're actually rewarding the liquidity providers, who are actually the sort of like the true risk takers, if you think about it, for providing liquidity. We're actually offering them the slippage. And we're kind of cutting out the arbitrage guys completely, which incentivizes people to come in and provide liquidity. So that's how these molecule pools are going to work, if that makes any sense, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing something pretty similar with our time flux pools. Yeah, a little bit different, but yeah, we just dropped a first iteration of that paper. I think we'll make it public probably next week, but we've been circling around some of our advisors and investors. We have one of them live already. They're denoted as hybrid pools on our UI. So we have one for XArch, SArch, slippage-free pools. But yeah, cool idea. You were asking more about like what our go-to-market strategy is, like how we source our clients. We look at clients a little bit differently. Right now, most AMMs, the revenue generated on the AMM is through trading primarily. But again, I usually it's not revenue generated by the AMM, just on the AMM. We're doing things differently where we earn revenue from the liquidity directly. So TVL is no longer a vanity metric, and doing so, sourcing liquidity is our primary go-to-market strategy. As we source liquidity, we expect to get more of the end user volume, because users will usually trade where liquidity exists, even if it's not on our UI. As we get things like TFM and other aggregators to route through us, that then gives us volume, but it's actually liquidity that matters to us more than volume. So yeah, we're just sourcing liquidity deals, basically showcasing how much they're having to spend because, you know, hosting liquidity is a cost that usually they have to pay out of pocket, and we're able to decentralize that expense as, you know, proper tokenomics should do, but has often been oversight and oversought in proof of stake ecosystems. So we're sourcing liquidity, assuming volume will come eventually. It will be an interesting experiment to see how it plays out.
Yeah, it's great that you bring up the liquidity issues because you're right. People do want to swap or participate where there's higher liquidity. And that's simply because of the friction involved, right? I mean, whether it's slippage, price impact, you know, just the difficulty of being able to conduct the business that you're trying to conduct. I think that's one of the problems we're trying to tackle as well is, can we actually have pools that can operate efficiently with much smaller quantities? Because if they do, one, it's a self-correcting problem. People will come and add to those pools. And two, it won't really matter, right? So because if they're still getting the same pricing that they would get in a large pool, then the user doesn't have to leave our ecosystem to go to another one to go and make that trade, make that swap, et cetera. So yeah, it's a very interesting problem when we think oracles are a start, right? That's a prerequisite to that, to try to make sure we get that best pricing.
Yeah, the dangers of that obviously are, one, if it's too functional, then you can completely lose liquidity in any side of that, which, I mean, it doesn't break the protocol, it just slows it down significantly. And two, you're limited to the liquidity that is available. So you can't process larger trades unless that liquidity first comes. But yeah, I mean, the idea of it's great. You can't take part in price discovery, but when you're doing things like margin trading, price discovery isn't very important because you probably should be margin trading things that are taking part in price discovery actively anyways. So I like the attempt. So there's definitely something to be held there. Are you limited to only using liquidity that exists on LS's network, or can you crowdsource liquidity for margin trading and work on other protocols?
Dreamcatcher, you want that one?
Yeah, right now we're just going to be using liquidity on LS for margin trading. But we actually also have another product, which I think I'm not sure if Haysha mentioned. It's essentially leverage yield farming, which we believe would be a big driver to bring in more liquidity into the ecosystem. It's basically a combination of USDC deposits. I call it the three pillars of LS network. One of them is USDC deposits, which basically earn, it's just simple staking of your USDC, which earns you yield. The yield is basically generated by guys who come in and borrow this USDC on leverage and provide liquidity. So liquidity yield farming. And then you got the third pillar, which is margin trading, which addresses the revenue aspect of the equation. And if you combine these three together and you kind of look at the dynamics and the synergy between the three different products which we are offering, you'll see that's sort of like self-sustaining. You kind of get one catalyst going and you got like all three working together. You get a self-sustaining ecosystem. That's what we're trying to do. So hopefully with these, you know, we should be able to tap in a decent amount of liquidity. And ultimately, you know, you're right about like people going to DEXs which have a lot of liquidity. And for margin trading, you do require a fair bit of liquidity so that you're not kind of like handicapped by, you know, one-sided liquidity being high or low. But I do think that, you know, some of the features that we have on DEX, such as slippage reduction, you know, Oracle-based arbitrage repricing, as well as this whole idea behind keeping the slippage for LPs and not getting into arbitrage guys is probably going to like attract liquidity providers to come onto LS, and then, you know, once we have that liquidity, we're hoping that, you know, margin traders come in and trade, you know, keeping the fees et cetera pretty low, but we're not aggregating or crowdsourcing liquidity from other platforms right now. We want to kind of build our own liquidity, and I think we have the product and the features to do that.
Cool. Thanks for the explanation. Bonus block, you guys have something?
Hey guys, great topics, all about the user base and how to attract them. I think one of the cool stuff that we are basically targeting is, first of all, how to get the on-chain users. So far, we are like building engagement protocols for every single network or ecosystem to get exposure to these kind of like protocols or solutions. But one thing that we are currently actually evaluating and we'll be implementing this year is to basically provide a way to acquire on-chain users. So the first step would be to evaluate users by checking their online activity, checking their network and exposure to various networks and applications. And then we assign them a dollar value. And this so-called solution provides a nice way for any project to acquire user base without spending money, without guarantees on marketing or agencies. So instead of doing that, you can easily choose what kind of like category of users you need. Either those are quality users with a lot of liquidity that are interested to provide and basically get acquired. And the way it works that you choose which of the tier of the user you want to have. And then we provide the so-called on-chain checkups or activities. Once you pay for the user group, these users will need to have their on-chain engagements based on your requirement. So those can be any on-chain mission. It can be liquidity providing, trading, whatever it can be. And then once the user have been completing those on-chain so-called activities, these users will then release partial of the payment that you have provided to us. It is completely revolutionizing how we basically acquire users on the Web3 side by sharing the so-called success fee, of course, because one thing is to incentivize the users in a way, but another way is to acquire the users that are committed, and also you have the guarantee that these users will deploy. And currently, of course, we are in the process of this, but more than welcome to any thoughts. But I think it's super nice because we'll be able to onboard existing 400 million of users onto the incentivized so-called protocol. We took the idea from X or Twitter or from this platform that they're incentivizing like active members and they're paying out monthly basis. I think it's the same or similar needed for the Web3 part, where basically projects are interested to get the users without like big efforts or big money. And we hope we're going to be solving this mysterious so-called adoption, right, that everybody needs.
That's a very
definitely a cool idea. Yeah. Where are you guys getting the revenues to incentivize these users?
Basically, the projects will be paying for what kind of like quality user you need. So we'll be so the user comes to our platform. They'll be connecting their wallet. We'll be then giving them a dollar value reward, and in which tier they're going to be grouped in. So after that, we then provide you so-called the user base and which tier you want to have. Do you want to have the smaller trader or user, or you want to have the medium or the quality guy, like the biggest tier, where basically they have a lot of liquidity because we have already analyzed that on-chain activity from them. So, and then you pay for each of the user and you say how much you need to have for these on-chain engagements or activities. And then, of course, you pay for each of these users. And how we distribute to the user end is we basically say that we will be taking, of course, partial fee, but then majority of everything will be then deployed to the user once they have met the on-chain activity, so-called mission requirements from you. So it's super easy and straightforward game, and everybody benefits.
So I see you cool. Partner with Archway. What are some other chains that you've been partnering with?
It's Injective Network currently, and then we are Nibiru chain, Burnt, and then we have also one of the launchpads also integrating us.
We're also going to use Bonus Block for part of our airdrop. It just seems like the easiest way to actually get activation for things.
Oh, that sounds like a very very cool. We'll definitely look into that. We'll chat with you guys.
Talk about
I think
airdrop,
after this.
So, is your token live yet, or are you guys gonna launch it later?
A token will be launched in December. This is not released, but we're doing our best. But currently, we're just working on the value proposition, right, for everybody. in the sector, because I myself, as a co-founder of the project, I mean, we do suffer one thing, is the big problem when you try to grow your social media side, but you don't get the most of the users that are following your profiles. And the way we want to do it is basically create this system that you can acquire these users. And it will be, at the end of the day, much, much cheaper. And plus, it will be guaranteed that these users will be committing to you, because that is how they're going to get paid as well.
Yeah, Zili, but for on-chain actions, makes way too much sense. The actual crypto version.
Right. Great. Yeah, that's a cool model. Yeah, I'm still trying to like figure out how the project, the new projects, you know, of course, you know, the projects who get funded by VCs, et cetera, will have a decent amount of like stashed money somewhere to give away to users to incentivize to come and use their platform. I'm still trying to understand how 95%, 99% of the new projects which come on will be able to acquire these customers or these end users, because they don't really have the, you know, the so kind of like a deep treasury. And so you're like, I believe so, you're basically targeting more kind of like funded projects, I'm assuming, right? You're not like targeting.
No. Our long-term growth, so-called goals are to support the new projects very much. So instead of like taking fees on our side, if you're like a new project, we want to incorporate later on, once we launch this feature, we want to incorporate some kind of like first support package. So you at least get 100 users or 200, whatever is your amount based on what kind of like application you have. We want to kind of like sponsor you. So in this way, we can really fast grow our client side and partners. But at the same time, we can always list these opportunities for our user base that we're going to be onboarding. So what we want to kind of like create is a massive shift in the Web3, how users are being acquired. Because now when we compare, we have no statistics around customer acquisition costs. We have barely numbers that are being spent from 3 to 7 times more than the standard tech technology companies are getting for customer acquisition costs. And the marketing budgets for these are usually between 25, even up to 95% from the funding or from the token side. So the numbers are showing that there's a huge need for this, because nobody knows how to best do it. Because if you pay $10K for influencer on the YouTube, do you really know that you're going to be guaranteed of these on-chain users? Not really. You might have an impact, but that will not be long-term growth. With us, we want to have this long-term growth. And so basically relationship with the users and also with your project. And I think we can definitely make it happen, because we're also working with different wallets to have a notification systems in place. Because one thing is to use existing infrastructure to notify about these campaigns and about your project, so we can get as much users as possible. Because our goal is to connect and basically give users the monetization possibilities, because they're committed to your project. I mean, that just makes sense, because blockchain was meant to be peer-to-peer, and everybody must win in the game. The same with the activities on-chain and also demand, because it is super frustrating for new projects now, because majority of the largest ones, they are providing quite a lot of funds when it comes to marketing agencies, bot activities, and etc. So they are pushing their silos on other users while you're being kind of like into the shadows, right? So we want to be that platform where you need to go to get the users.
Yeah, I mean, the other option, like you're talking about how difficult it is for companies that are starting out without a bunch of cash to acquire users. You look at Web2, I believe it was what 1 million applications being like launched a day on mobile stores. Like, that's wild. And most of them do get no users, and most of them do fail. And so that's a sign of the maturation of the Web3 space. So one option is, one, don't have the end user be your ideal client and build some kind of like a corporate infrastructure, like corporate middleware, which is kind of what like our going approach is. But two, it's make sure that you have a cost-effective way of reaching as many users as possible to showcase those metrics, even if it is like primarily to help you raise. But Bonus Block seems like the best way to do that, in my opinion. So we're doing both.
Yeah, I do think it's cool that, you know, we have different ways to try to kind of tackle some of these problems. And so, you know, the way that this is going to look going forward is going to be kind of adjusting and maybe cool, taking some best.
Hashim, are you still there? I see you like getting on and off.
Yeah, are you able to hear me?
Can you hear him?
No, can't.
Okay, try hopping out and back in. He is talking. The rest of us hear him.
Okay. All right.
Oh yeah, that is interesting. Okay, so yeah, it's very interesting that, you know, we try to tackle a lot of these problems in different ways, and I think as we work through it over the course of getting that feedback and, you know, taking the lessons learned, best practices, and then we'll probably have a lot of like similar components that we'll all put together and use as part of our strategies and acquiring users, and then other ones that aren't so successful we kind of dump off, right? And so, probably, I think we're going to feel this out, you know, all together as we move forward and figure out how this is going to work. But yeah, very, very exciting to see kind of the different angles that are being taken. And yeah, we wish you guys the best of success there with Bonus Block. We'll chat with you after as well. We'd love to kind of learn more about your offering.
Thank you as well. And thank you for taking the chance on getting me here to speak. So,
well, this is an open forum. We're happy to have anybody here. So, yeah, by all means.
One more question on the growth of Ellis. The AppChain thesis is great. You guys have a suite of projects that you're going to put together that should work cohesively. Do you plan to continually limit it to that if there is a surplus of block space, or are you open to other applications building not on top of your chain and working with you guys?
That's a great question. We certainly have not ruled that out. You know, obviously when we think about what we've accomplished so far, it's obviously been specific to just building that foundation. So if we do have a complete suite of financial applications, and then later on the way, we can find ways to build upon that based on user demand or what's out there in terms of, you know, value capture, I don't see why we wouldn't look at it. Right? I mean, we're certainly not saying no to anything at this stage of our development. So, but we do want to make sure that obviously the foundations that we're building are absolutely rock solid. So, you know, it's kind of interesting I've talked to a lot of developers and about, you know, just how difficult it is to build a DeFi project. And it's because, you know, when you're building a gaming project, when you're building streaming or some other type of service, you can make mistakes, right? You can have very buggy code, you know, not to say that's what they do, but you are allowed to have multiple iterations with problems, but you can't do that in DeFi and you can't do that in things like healthcare, right? So those would be your two areas where whenever you roll out a version of your release, it's got to be perfect. And we saw what happened when it wasn't, right? And so, that's kind of the focus for now, but we'd love to consider other options kind of once we've got that foundation built.
Sweet. Well, yeah,
I just want to add here that ultimately, if you want to scale and grow, that's probably the right way forward, right? Because you can't like be all like you want other dApps to come and build on your chain. You want other dApps to come in and use your products, as well as kind of integrate and synergize with what you're offering, because that's the only real way to grow. I was actually talking to like some devs on the ETH side today, and it's kind of cool what Injective just did, where they've kind of like they call it the in-EVM. I don't know if you read about them, but they just recently launched a platform where you can have like ETH guys basically come and build on Injective using Solidity. So I think what's really cool there is that you're seeing ecosystems come together, and you got like devs kind of like cross develop between different ecosystems, which is exactly what we want, right? Because I truly believe that in a few years' time, like, you know, users are not really going to care whether they're like on Ethereum or Solana or Cardano or like, you know, Cosmos or, you know, any of these chains or ecosystems. Doesn't really matter. What's going to matter is the product offering, either the UX and the UI, right? Because that, and of course, the security. So, so it, it
it's really cool to see these synergies between different ecosystems. We're seeing how IBC is connecting to non kind of Cosmos chains. You got like Polkadot just come in. You know, you got like other platforms who are trying to like use IBC and Lite clients to bring other ecosystems into Cosmos, and Composable is trying to do that. So I'm kind of excited from that perspective, and I think that's the only way to scale. You got to like bring other ecosystem, other devs from different ecosystems to come and kind of build within Cosmos or vice versa. You know, and I think that's going to happen, and it's already happening. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Absolutely. Well, if we both succeed, then we'll be able to bring a whole bunch of liquidity. You guys will build some incredible financial products, and then hopefully we can use some of our liquidity on your guys' financial products and make everything flow smoothly. Long-time fan of your team. Keep killing it, guys.
Yep. Yeah, thanks, Eric. I appreciate it. And we're fans of yours as well. We wish you continued success. And I've said this before as well, that the future of DeFi, especially in the Cosmos ecosystem, it's going to require multiple different places to conduct business, right? So it can't just be an Osmosis. It can't just be a Kujira. It's got to be, you know, if we think about now that Circle is bringing USDC and Tether is bringing USDT natively, you know, that's the building blocks for this big, massive expansion of what's going to be coming over the next 5-10 years. So we could have a multi-trillion dollar addressable market here within the Cosmos ecosystem, and it can't just be handled by one protocol. It can't just be handled by one DEX. So yeah, I wish you guys continued success, and thanks so much for your time today. I know we just hit an hour. So if anybody wants some light, you know, maybe ask a last minute question or anything before we close it up, the floor is yours.
I'll just hop on before we get off and just say that as I listen to the different iterations and the different approaches from you know, each of the companies, like Bonus Block got me excited too. I like listening to that because it's such a great approach to a common problem. It's a very expensive problem, matching a client with something, with a product that they need, and making it efficient and making sure that where they end up is where they're going to belong, you know. And man, I love that. So the other thing too that just gets me pumped up is listening to all the different ideas to try to tackle this problem after we all have been through a lot. And it just, that's why we're here, guys. We just got to remember that's why we're here, is because it's needed. There's so much potential. We're all on the same side. And, you know, I wish you guys, you know, an enormous amount of success. We'll be rooting for you. And so thanks, guys. This is awesome. I love it. I love the ideas. I love the innovation. Thanks, guys.
We will build the next bull market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. And Ethan, sorry we didn't get a chance to check in with you earlier, but do you have any closing words for us?
Oh, just thanks for having us, and thanks for the coverage, guys. Look forward to what you're building. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Really appreciate everyone's time today. This is recorded, so it will be available. We'll have it obviously posted on our profile, and I think you guys have it as well on Astro Vault. So thanks, everyone, for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy, before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come first serve mentality, stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Motherfuckers walking around here looking faceless, trying to make a living selling friendship bracelets. Dead ants dragging out the max amount of payments. Red down days, got them acting all bankless. Yo fam, what? Check these tokenomics. They probing this bear, flexing broken honest. I had to lay my soul down, I'm just roasting otters. And then to end a long day, 11 bowls of chronic. Never known the politic, I was born to frolic. It's been my policy to pollinate all over the plot. We got a lot of apologists jumping in at the top. We like to measure their velocity before they hit rock bottom. Over impossible loss, it's all moss, and I'm liking the odds. Fondue in the morning, forming mycological bonds. Flick the cap, yo, the road is highly involved. Flip a coin, diary fall. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy, before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come first serve mentality, stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play, ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Trying to figure out the max amount of dinner lay stacked in non-toxic, just to get a better place. Smacking on the hostage like the shit is play for keeps. Clowns, white knight, and all these Maybellines. They call it implausible when model after model keeps on ripping off the coat and going full throttle. Eats tearing apart your community. All these low-hanging
fruits bearing zero liquidity. Got a planet in reach, coming standard to each. I'm on the back 10, stargazing after the siege. Commanding all the management to grab a few Z's, and then we'll round up the beasts and send a messenger east. Y'all better sign a release when I'm bumping these beats. Hands up if I got motherfuckers drumming the streets. Yo, we got a few dubs, we got a couple defeats, and if you're coming for the king, you better have some of each. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the verbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play. Ring around the rosy while the thunder is served.
Terror Spaces.